Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the January 5th Wednesday edition of the Denver Post. My name is Bill Head. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Hospitals, Metro Facilities Nearing Capacity by Meg Wingerter. Former Bronco North Glen Mayor Businessman Dies at 80 by Kyle Newman, the Denver Post. Culture Wars Hit Teachers After Riots by Heather Hollingsworth, the Associated Press. Hospitals, Metro Facilities Nearing Capacity. Omicron surge threatens to knock out more staff, health leaders warn, by Meg Wingerter, the Denver Post. Denver area hospitals are already running out of beds, and the situation could get worse as the Omicron variant continues to spread and healthcare workers get sick, hospital and public health leaders warn Tuesday. Statewide, 1,292 people were hospitalized with confirmed COVID-19 as of Tuesday afternoon, a significant jump from 1,167 hospitalizations one day earlier. About 93% of both intensive care and general beds were full. Kathy Howell, chief nursing officer at University of Colorado Hospital, said staff had been battling a surge for 4 months now and are exhausted. While COVID-19 hospitalizations fell between Thanksgiving and Christmas, they remained at high levels and now are rising again as hospitals continue to operate with little cushion. As of Tuesday, 98% of University of Colorado Hospital's intensive care beds were full, and the hospital was operating over capacity with less severely ill patients in converted surge areas, Howell said. Denver hospitals have had to turn away out-of-state patients looking for beds because they don't have the resources to care for them, she said. Nurses already were burning out and leaving, and now the Omicron variant is throwing more challenges at hospitals, Howell said. Even vaccinated staff are getting sick and having to stay home because Omicron causes more breakthrough infections. This is probably going to be the scariest point of the pandemic over the next month, she said during a news briefing with Denver Public Health and hospital officials. Last week's wildfires compounded the problem because smoke damage forced Vista Adventist Hospital in Louisville to close temporarily. The hospital is licensed to operate 114 beds, though the actual number of patients that any facility can treat depends on staffing. Bob McDonald, executive director of the Denver Department of Public Health and Environment, pleaded with all Coloradans who haven't been vaccinated to get the shot. Only about half of the people in Denver hospitals now are city residents, with most of the rest coming from other parts of the state, he said. The virus has taken and will continue to take the lives of unvaccinated people, he said. Vaccines and masks will also be vital tools in keeping schools open in the coming months, said Dr. David Brumbaugh, chief medical officer at Children's Hospital of Colorado. Kids suffer when the schools close, and Omicron could lead to larger outbreaks without measures to keep transmission in check, he said. We owe it to our kids to do everything we can to keep them safe and healthy in school, he said. The public health officials on the call said they have no plans to order schools to close, but if too many teachers get sick, districts may have no choice but to return to remote learning. About 1 in 100 Denver residents have tested positive for COVID-19 over the past week, Mayor Michael Hancock said. The city's 7-day positivity rate is 25.1%, meaning 1 in 4 tests is coming back positive, suggesting the actual number of residents with the virus is likely higher. Public health officials hope to see positivity rates below 5%. Hancock, who was fully vaccinated and received a booster shot, tested positive last weekend. He said he's experiencing mild cold-like symptoms and urged others to get a third shot as soon as they become eligible. It will keep you out of the hospital, he said. On Tuesday morning, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention announced people who received the Pfizer shots only had to wait 5 months after their second dose, down from the previous 6-month recommendation. People who received the Johnson & Johnson vaccine only have to wait 2 months, while those who receive Moderna still have to wait 6 months. The CDC also recommended booster shots for children ages 5 to 11 who have compromised immune systems. Its Immunization Advisory Committee will consider whether to recommend boosters for all kids 12 to 15 in the coming days. Nationwide, more than 103,000 people were hospitalized with COVID-19 as of Monday, according to the Washington Post. The record for hospitalization set in mid-January 2021 was about 142,000. Dr. Connie Price, Chief Medical Officer at Denver Health, said most patients hospitalized with the Omicron variant aren't as severely ill as those who had previous versions of the virus. But the current surge hit a hospital workforce that's already depleted. Denver Health has some intensive care beds available, but its general beds are full, she said. Without enough people to care for them, patients are having to wait longer in emergency rooms, and some are being transferred out of Denver to hospitals with more space, Price said. The statewide hospital transfer center sends sicker patients to hospitals that offer higher levels of care, typically in the metro area, while some of those who are less sick go to rural facilities. The only way to get out of the pandemic is for enough people to get vaccinated that hospitals aren't overturned, Price said. While Omicron cases dropped suddenly in South Africa after a meteoric rise, there's no sign Colorado's current surge is close to being over, she said. We don't appear to be plateauing yet, she said. I think we're in for a tough 2 or 3 weeks. January 6th, Culture Wars Hit Teachers After Riots, by Heather Hollingsworth, the Associated Press. Mission, Kansas. What students are learning about the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th may depend on where they live. In a Boston suburb in heavily Democratic Massachusetts, history teacher Justin Voldman said his students will spend the day journaling about what happened and talking about the fragility of democracy. I feel really strongly that this needs to be talked about, said Voldman, who teaches history at Natick High School, 15 miles west of Boston. As the grandson of a Holocaust survivor, he said it is fair to draw parallels between what happened on January 6th and the rise of fascism. Voldman said he feels fortunate. There are other parts of the country where I would be scared to be a teacher. Liz Wagner, an 8th and 9th grade social studies teacher in Des Moines, suburb of increasingly Republican Iowa, got an email from an administrator last year warning teachers to be careful in how they frame the discussion. I guess I was so, I don't know if naive is the appropriate word, perhaps exhausted from the pandemic teaching year last year to understand how controversial this was going to be, she said. Some students questioned Wagner last year when she referred to what happened as an insurrection. She responded by having them read the dictionary definition for the word. This year, she will probably show students videos of the protests and ask them to write about what the footage shows. This is kind of what I have to do to ensure that I'm not upsetting anybody, Wagner said. Last year, I was on the front line of the COVID war, trying to dodge COVID, and now I'm on the front line of a culture war, and I don't want to be there. With crowds shouting at school board members meeting, school board meetings, and political action committees investing millions of dollars in races to elect conservative candidates across the country, talking to students about what happened on January 6th is increasingly fraught. Teachers now are left to decide how or whether to instruct their students about the events that sit at the heart of the country's division. And lessons sometimes vary based on whether they are in a red state or a blue state. Facing History and Ourselves, a nonprofit that helps teachers with difficult lessons on subjects like the Holocaust, offered tips on how to broach the topic with students in the hours after the riot. Within 18 hours of publication, it had 100,000 page views, a level of interest that Abby Weiss, who oversees the development of the nonprofit's teaching tools, said was unlike anything the group has seen before. In the year that has followed, Weiss said, Republican lawmakers and governors in many states have championed legislation to limit the teaching of material that explores how race and racism influence American politics, culture, and law. Teachers are anxious, she said. On the face of it, if you read the laws, they're quite vague and, you know, hard to follow, actually, what's permissible and what isn't. Racial discussions are hard to avoid when discussing the riot because white supremacists were among those descending on the halls of power, said Jenny Spiegler, director of curriculum and training for the Anti-Defamation League. She said the group is concerned that the insurrection could be used as a recruitment tool and wrote a newly released guide to help teachers and parents combat those radicalization efforts. To talk about white supremacy, to talk about white supremacist extremists, to talk about the racist Confederate flag, it's fraught for so many reasons, Spiegler said. Anton Schultzky, the president of the National Council of Social Studies, said students are often the ones bringing up the racial issues. Last year, he was just moments into discussing what happened when one of the honors students at William J. Palmer High School in Colorado Springs said, you know, if those rioters were all black, they'd all be arrested by now. Since then, three conservative school board candidates won seats on the school board where Schultzky teaches, and the district dissolved its equity leadership team. He is covered by a contract that offers academic freedom protections and has discussed the riot periodically over the past year. I do feel, he said, that there may be some teachers who are going to feel the best thing for me to do is to ignore this because I don't want to put myself in jeopardy because I have my own bills to pay, my own house to take care of, and my own kids to take back and forth to school. Concerned teachers have been reaching out to the American Federation of Teachers, which last month sued over New Hampshire's new limits on the discussion of systemic racism and other topics. What I'm hearing now over and over again is that these laws that have been passed in different places are really intended to chill the discussion of current events, said Randy Weingarten, the union's president and a former social studies teacher. I am very concerned about what it means in terms of the teaching as we get closer and closer to January 6th. The biggest fear for Paula Davis, a middle school special education teacher in a rural central Indiana district, is that the discussion about what happened could be used by teachers with a political agenda to indoctrinate students. She won't discuss January 6th in her classroom. Her focus is math and English. I think it's extremely important that any teacher that is addressing that topic does so from an unbiased perspective, said Davis, a regional chapter chair for Moms for Liberty, a group whose members have protested mask and vaccine mandates and critical race theory. If it cannot be done without bias, then it should not be done. But there is no way Dylan Huskin will avoid the topic in his middle school classroom in Missoula, Montana, area town of Bonner. He plans to use the anniversary to teach his students to use their voice constructively by doing things like writing to lawmakers. Not addressing the attack, Huskin said, is to suggest that the civic ideals we teach exist in a vacuum and don't have any real-world application, that civic knowledge is mere trivia. Odell Berry, Former Bronco, North Glen mayor, businessman, dies at 80 by Kyle Newman, the Denver Post. Odell Berry, the former Broncos player and North Glen mayor, who left an indelible impact on Metro Denver, died Monday after a battle with congestive heart disease. He was 80. Berry first made his name with the Broncos, but it was post-football achievements that gilded his legacy. In 1980, he became the first black elected mayor in a major city in Colorado. After his term was over, Berry led a life rich in altruism, political activism, entrepreneurship, and real estate. He was a mentor, a supporter, and someone who was a giant in our community and our state, U.S. Rep. Joe Neguse said. He's someone who's going to be sorely missed. He was tenacious on the field as a former football player and all-star athlete, but for me, what I'll remember most is his willingness to mentor and to support young black men and women who were working to try to serve the public. Born on October 10, 1941 in Memphis, Tennessee, Berry grew up in Toledo, Ohio, and the Broncos took him out of the University of Findlay in the 19th round in the 1964 American Football League draft. Berry, who was also a standout sprinter, opted for pro football over a chance to join the U.S. Olympic team. Over two seasons with Denver, Berry appeared in 26 games as a return specialist and wideout, amassing 2,215 total return yards. As a rookie, he returned a punt for a touchdown and led the league in kickoff returns. 47, still tied first in Broncos history, and return yards, 1,245, ranks second. Repeated hard hits required surgery, leaving Berry with one kidney and a scar running down his stomach and ending his football career. But Berry was just getting started etching his legacy in North Glen, which recently proposed naming a park after him. He began as the North Glen Recreation Center, then moved into politics, and became the owner of Colorado's first full-service Dairy Queen in the early 1970s. Berry served on the North Glen City Council from 1972 to 1979 before being elected mayor, and then remained a major figure in the Colorado Democratic Party after leaving office. Along the way, he took pride in organizing the Multiple Sclerosis Dinner of Champions for many years and running the North Glen football camp. His biggest legacy is what he did for the youth, said Berry's son Damon. He mentored so many youth in North Glen and the whole state. Being an African-American man in predominantly white city like North Glen, and being as well respected as he was in the 70s, and that's never changing, that's special. People of all colors and likes and creeds really look up to him and respected him. He used that status to help mold the next generation. He founded Berry & Associates, a real estate and consulting company, and Berry also won appointments to several civic and state posts. He served as chairman of the Colorado Economic Development Commission, and then in 2011, amid the fallout of the Great Depression, was tapped by then Denver Mayor Guillermo Bill Vidal to serve on a task force charged with fixing the city's structural deficit. Berry was also a member of the Colorado Baseball Commission in the early 1990s that helped pave the way for the founding of the Rockies as a Major League Baseball expansion team. And later that decade, he chaired the site selection committee for a new stadium for the Broncos. Odell was a great civic leader who was also out for betterment of the community, Rockies owner Dick Monfort said. I met Odell much later than his involvement in bringing baseball to Denver, but considered him a friend and a very genuine person. Among Berry's most many protégés were Neguse and current Denver Mayor Michael Hancock. Both recalled Berry's advice and networking opening doors for them as young politicians. When I was running for my first political office as CU Regent, he and his wife Glenda opened their doors and hosted one of my very first fundraising events for my campaign, Neguse recalled. The same held true a decade later when I called to ask for his help when I was running to become the first black congressman in our state. He was there for me again. But what makes that memory so unique, I suppose, is that it's not uncommon. I'm one of many, many young people that he helped and he mentored and supported and gave time to. Hancock credited Barry's influence in helping save the Urban League of Metropolitan Denver in the late 1990s, which in turn enabled his rise to the mayor's office. He was an astute businessman, but more than that, he carried a lot of water for the current black politicians in Colorado, Hancock said. Not only for me, but for Denver's first black mayor, Wellington Webb, too, quite frankly. Odell opened the door, and he desensitized Colorado to the fact that African Americans can lead cities in this state. Wellington Webb rode on his shoulders, and I rode on Wellington Webb's shoulders, and I just kept going. He was a black political pioneer here. Negus described Barry as a generous man with his time and resources, someone with kindness and wit who could make you laugh, but he could also inspire you to do bigger things. I think of Odell as a friend and as of someone who made a real difference in the building of a metropolitan Denver community, Wellington Webb said. Odell was intricate in that as his family, his wife Glenda, and now his sons, it's a loss for me personally and a loss for the community as a whole. Barry is survived by his wife, his sons, Jay and Damon, and four grandchildren. Services are still being finalized, and his funeral will be open to the public. Shooting spree. Denver police received warning. A year before Rampage, German man tipped off authorities to Gunman's Books by Elise Schmelzer of the Denver Post. Denver police received a warning a year ago about the man who killed five people in an attack across the Denver metro, and the book The Gunman wrote detailing some of the killings. A German man contacted Denver 311 on January 3, 2021 about Lyndon McLeod and wrote, "I think there's a small but undeniable possibility that the accused may commit a terrorist attack." The German man, Andre Thiele, said in an interview Monday with the Denver Post that he contacted Denver police after reading McLeod's books and participating in a chat room for fans of the book. The gunman's participated in the chat and made increasingly alarming statements that prompted Thiele to contact authorities, Thiele said. Thiele also submitted a tip online to the FBI and sent them a letter via mail, he said. "I cannot, in good conscience, say that he will act with certainty," Thiele wrote in a letter to Denver police, which he provided to the Post. "But I can say that if he should act, the result would be devastating. He then would stop at nothing." Denver police on Tuesday confirmed they received a tip from a person in Germany in January 2021, citing concerns about McLeod, including information about a fraud that involved a potential victim outside of Colorado. Denver police could not link McLeod to a Denver address and had no reason to believe McLeod was living in Denver at the time, Denver police spokesman Doug Shetman said in a statement. DPD is reviewing the investigation, but based on our initial review, there was not sufficient evidence to file criminal charges or a legal basis for monitoring McLeod at the time, Shetman said. The review of the January 2021 investigation will also include whether detectives read McLeod's books, Shetman said. The self-published books described a character named Lyndon McLeod killing some of the people he killed during his December 27th spree of violence. Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin previously said that McLeod had been the subject of two law enforcement investigations, one in 2020 and one in early 2021. He refused during a December 28th press conference to elaborate on the nature of the investigations. FBI officials have failed to release any information about what they knew about McLeod prior to the killings. They declined to answer questions from the Post on December 29th and December 30th and did not respond Tuesday to an email about Thiele's tip. Email records Thiele provided to the Denver Post showed that a Denver police detective contacted Thiele via email on January 4th, 2021 and said he would look into his concerns. Thiele sent the detective two documents that outlined his concerns about McLeod and included statements McLeod made in the chat room that worried Thiele. He included a link to a listing for McLeod's book on Amazon. Though the book is not political per se, it could be read as an extremist right-wing manifesto and a terrorist prophecy, Thiele wrote in one of the documents. It may very well be that the accused is a typical case of a literary genius and a petty thug who runs his mouth and talks too much, Thiele wrote. I would, from my personal experiences, say that this might be a 90% chance, but there is a 10% chance that he has, at least in his own mind, created the perfect storm of right-wing terrorism. The detective responded a few minutes later thanking Thiele for contacting Denver police and said he would reach out if he had any further questions. That was the last Thiele heard from the department, Thiele said, though he later heard from at least two people he listed in a letter that they had been contacted by law enforcement. Thiele did not know at the time he made his report to police that some of the people McLeod's main character killed in the books were real people. Thiele at first was a fan of McLeod and his book and started interacting with him in 2019. It wasn't until he participated in a fansonly chat room with McLeod that he became alarmed. McLeod recommended books that were essentially neo-Nazi pamphlets, Thiele said, and made concerning remarks about wanting to start a war. Only after I got to know him better and the reality of his life and the reality of his points of view, I realized that this was not a novel but a manifesto or a letter of commitment, Thiele said Monday. Thiele said he didn't know if his alarm was more than a hunch, but wanted trained law enforcement professionals to take a look at McLeod and complete their own risk assessment. Tragically, they didn't see what I saw, he said. I saw through the jokes and I saw the guy underneath it. I'm sad I couldn't prove it. Now I'll be reading from the Denver Post obituaries. Leora Lee Adkins, February 11, 1926 to December 24, 2021. Westminster, Colorado was called home at the age of 95. Funeral at 2 p.m. on January 7, 2022 at Olinger Crown Hill with viewing at 1 p.m. Burial and reception to follow. Dr. Barry Beal, May 27, 1932 to December 15, 2021. Dr. Barry Beal, 89 years young, of Denver, Colorado, passed away peacefully at his home on December 15, 2021. Born in Holyoke, Colorado on May 27, 1932, predeceased in death by his loving wife, Jane Marie, of 68 years of marriage, and his beautiful daughter, Leanne Eileen. Survived by his grateful son, Barry Jr., three grandchildren, and five great-grandchildren. He touched many lives as an educator, teacher, and administrator during his 30-year career with the Denver Public Schools, along with his many years of service with the Board of Directors of Westera Credit Union. The presence of his absence is everywhere. Howard Fetty, August 19, 1932 to December 27, 2021. For full obituary, please visit cfcscolorado.org/obituaries. Alan Fisher, May 23, 1944 to December 31, 2021, Johnson City, Tennessee. Alan Lester Fisher, 77, of Johnson City, Tennessee in Littleton, Colorado, passed away from Lewy body dementia on December 31, 2021 in Bristol, Tennessee. Survived by Sandra Barnes Fisher, wife of 24 years, son Jeff Fisher, wife Monica and daughter Jennifer Thornton, husband Chuck, brothers Kenneth, wife Molly and Jimmy, wife Deborah, grandchildren Michael and Maria, fur baby Izzy the cat, as well as several nieces, nephews, and cousins. Alan had a successful career in civil construction, working for such companies as Western Empire, Summit, and Garney. He enjoyed walking, fly fishing, sailing, and watching the Denver Broncos. He lived most of his life in Denver, Colorado, as well as Illinois, Georgia, Florida, and Tennessee. Alan will be remembered as the best husband and loving, caring, and supporting father. His career was very important to him as he was diligent, detailed, and was valued. Online condolences may be made to the Fisher family at eastlawnkingsport.com. East Lawn Funeral Home and Memorial Park has the honor of serving the Fisher family. Dolores D. Harrell, June 25th, 1933 to January 2nd, 2022. Loving wife, mother, and grandma. Funeral services Saturday, January 8th, 2022 at 11 a.m. at Drink Wine Chapel. Full details at drinkwinemortuary.com. Nancy Lake, February 2nd, 1933 to December 25th, 2021. Nancy Lake Newman passed away peacefully at Collier Hospice in Wheat Ridge on December 25th, 2021 at 88 years old. Nancy, Nana, was a devoted mother, grandmother, sister, and friend to so many. She came into this world on February 3rd, 1933 to Leonard and Ruth Newman in Omaha, Nebraska. She moved with her family to Denver when she was 8, where she grew up in the Park Hill neighborhood and graduated from East High School in 1950. She earned an associate degree in business administration at the University of Denver. She was married in 1952 to Alan L. Lake. They divorced in 1982. She had a successful career as vice president of administration for Mediden, Inc. for 25 years. She is survived by her children, Mark, wife Sheila, Marcy Coronin, husband David, and Alan Jr., wife Sherry. Her two grandchildren, Addie Coronin and Jonas Coronin, wife Brittany, and her sisters, Barbara Moore and Linda Crow, husband Harv, and several nieces and nephews. She is cherished and missed by all who knew her. Services will be arranged at a later time. In lieu of flowers, please make contributions to the Arthritis Foundation, arthritis.org/Colorado. David Melton, May 29, 1947 to December 18, 2021. Celebration of life on January 11th at 1:30 at Raccoon Creek Golf Course. For more information, please go to HEFLEBOWERFUNERALSERVICES.com. Dorothy Dottie Razo, June 3rd, 1943 to December 22nd, 2021. For full obituary and services, visit newcomerdenver.com. Robert Leroy Sanchez. Robert Leroy Sanchez, 66, passed away on December 28, 2021 in Westminster, Colorado. Leroy, as he was known by all who loved him, was born in Los Animas, Colorado, and raised in Pueblo, Colorado. Leroy graduated from East High School in 1973. He joined the U.S. Army following graduation and served for 2 years. During his period of service, Leroy received the National Defense Service Medal. He continued service to the community through a career in print news. He retired from the Denver Post in 2017 after 33 years. Leroy married Florence Martinez in 1977 and completed their family with 2 sons. He enjoyed fishing, playing pool, and being a grandfather and great-grandfather. He is survived by his wife, Flo, his sons, Robert, wife Noel Sanchez Jr., and David, wife Amy Sanchez. His grandchildren, Alyssa, husband Dylan, Gamez, Andrew, wife Lacey, Brom, Isaac Sanchez, Kalub, Hewlett, Lily Sanchez, Jordan Sanchez, Khaleesi Sanchez, Araya Sanchez, three great-grandchildren, his mother, Thelma Sanchez, siblings, Ben, wife, Denise Sanchez, Tina, husband, Ken, Gully, Gloria, husband, Tom Brooks, and Carol Sanchez, and many nieces and nephews. Leroy was preceded in death by his father, Benjamin Sanchez. A funeral mass will be held Friday, January 7, 2022, at 10 a.m. at St. Joseph's Church, with interment to follow at Roselawn Cemetery. Online condolences can be made at roselawnpueblo.org. Arlene Selk, 1926 to 2021. Arlene D. Selk entered eternal rest on December 30th, 2021 in Denver, Colorado. She lived in South Dakota and Iowa for her first 20-plus years and married Vernon Whitey Selk in Iowa in 1945. They also lived in California and Minnesota before moving to Aurora, Colorado in 1969. Whitey passed away in 1977. She was very active and loved bowling, golfing, and walking her dog. She was an active member of St. Mark's Lutheran Church in Aurora until she entered assisted living. She is survived by her five children, Deanna Mooney, husband John, Bruce Selk, wife Sandy, Trudy Wiseman, husband Rob, Candace Barnes, husband Mark, and Brian Selk, wife Kelly, along with nine grandchildren, six great-grandchildren, and one great-great-grandson. A family service will be held in the spring in her memory. Donations may be made to Gateway Domestic Violence Services, P.O. Box 914, Aurora, Colorado, 80040. Please visit foothillsfuneral.com to leave condolences, view photos, or share a story. Now I'll be reading some miscellaneous articles from the Denver Post. What's new in 22? The most anticipated Denver area restaurant openings by Josie Sexton, the Denver Post. At the start of the year, we're tracking nine new restaurants set to debut in 2022. In no particular order, a Colorado Mexican institution, which is a reopening to be exact, a local Mezcal Brands cantina, a Los Angeles French transplant, a woman-led members club, a modern cabaret, and four local expansions from Littleton to Boulder. Some trends we're noticing among these openings. Mexican food continues to rule in many forms. Hotel restaurants are a safer bet for chefs and entrepreneurs, and successful local concepts tend to multiply. Time will tell if 2022 is the year of the post-pandemic restaurant comeback. Casa Bonita, do call it a comeback. This longtime Lakewood entertainment destination should soon have the food to match its crazy cliff-diving antics. After a tumultuous pandemic ride, the restaurant will reopen sometime in the second half of 2022, led by beloved Denver-based chef Dana Rodriguez. You might recognize the restaurant's new owners too, Trey Parker and Matt Stone, creators of South Park. Cantina Loca, another development from Dana Rodriguez. This new bar is set to open in January 12th at 2800 Zuni Street in Denver's Highland neighborhood. The cantina should fit in well alongside Rodriguez's existing Denver concepts, Work in Class, Super Mega Bien, and Dona Loca Mezcal. It will serve a selection of tequilas, mezcals, and cocktails, as well as Mexico City's street food. LA-based Ludo Lefebvre opens his first Colorado restaurant January at the new Thompson Hotel in Denver, downtown Denver, at 16th and Market Streets. It's named after Lefebvre's late mother-in-law. His wife, Chrissy, is originally from here. At the classy new brasserie, guests can expect Denver French omelets, bison Borsig Bourguignon, a whole assortment of steak, frites, and burgers, a la Fibre's famous Big Mech. Birch Road, opening in the spring at 3845 Lepan Street, Birch Road should be a first for Denver. A woman-owned BYOB clubhouse with a membership model much like a gym or co-working space. Monthly membership, $105 for one member and two guests, includes a bottle locker and access to private event spaces as well as the members' lounge, where there's a full bar set up for hosting gatherings without a tab to pay at the end of the night. Five Nines. This craft cocktail bar bills itself as hidden but not secret. Located inside the Clayton Members Club and Hotel, 233 Clayton Street in Cherry Creek. The space was first set to debut over the summer soon after Clayton was unveiled, but was delayed. Drinkers will finally experience the live performances, bespoke drinks, and small bites sometime in February. The Cherry Cricket. By late 2022, Littleton will get its outpost of the Cherry Cricket at 819 West Littleton Boulevard. The cricket has been a Denver mainstay for more than 70 years and now has two locations in Cherry Creek and Ballpark. This newest location will include a 100-person patio and burger garden, plus all the pork green chili and cricket burgers we've come to love. Balada. After a successful start at The Source in Denver, this Mexican restaurant is expanding. Head chef Manny Barella will bring his Monterey Mexican cuisine to 4580 Broadway in North Boulder earlier this year. Watch for Barella's takes on esquites, street corn, shrimp tacos, chili rellenos, and more. Curtis Park Deli. A favorite Denver sandwich shop is also expanding to Boulder at 3000 Pearl Parkway. Curtis Park Deli already has two locations, the original and namesake, as well as a newer 6th Avenue outpost. Soon diners in Boulder will be able to try the Curtis corned beef, sauerkraut, and Swiss, or the French ham, brie, and mixed greens. Dressings are made in-house and breads are baked fresh daily. Cholan. Fans of Denver's own French onion soup dumplings will have a new spot to pop them when Cholan opens its third location in late summer or early fall. Coming to the Lakeshore Denver residences in Sloan's Lake, the newest Cholan will feature mezzanine seating and views over the lake. And it's going to be joined by another new restaurant concept in the same family. Details and later are still in the works. January 6th, riots led to changes at U.S. Capitol Police by Michael Balsamo and Farnoosh Amiri, the Associated Press. Washington. A year after thousands of violent pro-Trump rioters overwhelmed police officers at the U.S. Capitol, severely injuring dozens in the process, the force dedicated to protecting the premier symbol of American democracy has transformed. The leaders who were in charge of the U.S. Capitol Police on January 6th were ousted following criticism for intelligence and other failures that left the legislative branch vulnerable, to the stunning attack. And more broadly, the agency that was once little known outside of Washington now has an elevated profile, leading to a roughly 15% increase in funding and a greater awareness of its role in the patchwork of groups that protected the region. With the nation's political divide running deep and an unprecedented number of threats against lawmakers, there is still concern about the readiness of the Capitol Police to thwart another attack. But experts say the shock of the insurrection has prompted needed changes, including better communication among the Capitol Police, other law enforcement agencies, and the public. It's a sea of change between this year and last year in terms of how the Capitol Police are thinking and operating, said Chuck Wexler, the head of the Police Executive Research Forum, an organization that focuses on professionalism and policing. They're going to be overprepared and willing to be criticized for being overprepared. As the temporary public face of the department, then acting police chief Yogananda Pittman conceded to Congress in February that multiple levels of failures allowed rioters to storm the building. But she disputed the notion that law enforcement had failed to take the threat seriously, noting how Capitol Police, several days before the riot, had distributed an internal document warning that extremists were posed for violence. J. Thomas Manger, the former chief of the police departments in Fairfax County, Virginia, and Montgomery County, Maryland, was chosen as the new chief. Manger has focused on making major changes to the agency, which includes 1,800 sworn police officers and nearly 400 civilian employees. He's ordered new equipment for frontline officers and officers assigned to the Civil Disturbance Unit while expanding training sessions with the National Guard and other agencies. He's also pushed for stronger peer support and mental health services for officers. I think that the damage that was done on January 6th was not just the physical damage to the Capitol itself, Manger said in an interview in September. The damage went beyond that. It went to where it damaged, I think, the confidence of the American public that the Capitol could be adequately protected. In the last year, Capitol Police say they have also improved the way that investigators gather, analyze, and disseminate intelligence and have brought on someone dedicated to planning major events to focus on intelligence and coordination. The agency also has started conducting planning sessions and exercises ahead of major events and is briefing officers in person. Many officers within the department had criticized their own leaders, saying that they had failed to recognize the threat ahead of the insurrection and didn't do enough to bolster staffing. Some of the officers were outfitted with equipment for a protest rather than a riot. But even with a new chief and major changes to operations, questions still remain about whether the Capitol is adequately protected. Senator Mark Warner, Democrat, Virginia, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee has said only a small number of the recommendations he made to make the Capitol complex safe and secure have been adopted. And he says they were clear systematic issues identified after the insurrection. The department still lacks an overall training infrastructure to meet the needs of the department, the level of intelligence gathering and expertise needed, and an overall cultural change needed to move the department into a protective agency as opposed to the traditional police department, Inspector General Michael Bolton told lawmakers on the Senate Rules Committee last month. AP poll. 4 in 10 in GOP say January 6th very violent, by Farnoosh Amiri, the Associated Press. The fighting, so primitive and ferocious that one Capitol Police officer described it as medieval and another as a trip to hell, left more than 100 law enforcement personnel injured, some beaten with their own weapons. Video cameras capture the violence, with rioters clubbing officers with flagpoles and fire extinguishers, even squeezing one between doors as he begged for his life. Yet nearly after the January 6th siege, only about 4 in 10 Republicans recalled the attack by supporters of then-President Donald Trump as very violent or extremely violent, according to a new poll from the Associated Press, NORC, Center for Public Affairs Research. About 3 in 10 Republicans say the attack was not violent, and about another 3 in 10 say it was somewhat violent. Overall, about 2/3 of Americans described that day as very or extremely violent, including about 9 in 10 Democrats. The findings reflect the county's political polarization. Country's polarization with a false portrayal of the siege taking hold despite extensive footage that shows the ransacking of the building in harrowing detail. Trump and some allies in Congress and conservative media have played it down, falsely characterizing the attack as a minor civil disturbance. My understanding was that a lot of it was pretty peaceful, Paul Bender, a self-described conservative from Cleveland, said in a recent interview. I've seen some video of the people just like marching in through a velvet rope. Bender, who said he couldn't keep up with the news coverage, added, "They were certainly outlier people who were not peaceful and were breaking through the windows and stuff like that, but I wasn't aware of the overt violence." Meanwhile, the percentage of Americans who blame Trump for the January 6th riot has grown slightly over the past year, with 57% said he bears significant responsibility for what took place. In the AP-NORC poll taken in the days after the attack, 50% said that. The uptick is seen among Republicans as well, even as relatively few think Trump bears significant responsibility. 22% that say that now, up from 11% last year. 60% say they had little to no responsibility. More workers quit jobs than ever, by Ben Castleman, the New York Times company. The number of Americans quitting their jobs is the highest on record, as workers take advantage of strong employer demand to pursue better opportunities. More than 4.5 million people voluntarily left their jobs in November, the Labor Department said Tuesday. That was up from 4.2 million in October and was the most in two decades that the government has been keeping track. The surge in quitting in recent months, along with continuing difficulty reported by employers and filing openings, underscores the strange, contradictory moment facing the U.S. economy after years of pandemic-induced disruptions. Much of the discussion about the increase in quitting, sometimes referred to as the Great Resignation, has focused on white-collar workers reevaluating their priorities in the pandemic. But job turnover has been concentrated in hospitality and other low-wage sectors, where intense competition for employees has given workers leverage to seek better pay. This Great Resignation story is really more about lower-wage workers finding new opportunities in a reopening labor market and seizing them, said Nick Bunker, director of economic research at the Indeed Hiring Lab. For some workers, the rush to reopen the economy has created a rare opportunity to demand better pay and working conditions. But for those who can't change jobs as easily or who are in sectors where demand isn't as strong, pay gains have been more modest and have been overwhelmed by faster inflation. Data from the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta shows that job switchers are getting significantly faster pay increases than people who stay in their jobs. The stubborn nature of the pandemic itself contributed to the problems, upending spending patterns and keeping workers on the sidelines. There are signs that the worst of this turbulence was beginning to ease late last year. The number of job openings posted by employers fell in November, the Labor Department said Tuesday, though it remained high by historical standards. Hiring picked up, too. Earlier data showed that more people returned to the labor force in November and various measures of supply chain pressures began to ease. But that was before the explosion in coronavirus cases linked to the Omicron variant, which has forced airlines to cancel flights, businesses to delay return to office plans, and school districts to return temporarily to remote learning. Forecasters say the latest COVID-19 wave is all about to prolong the economic uncertainty. It is too soon to say how it will affect inflation, spending, or the job market. Despite the demand for workers and the pay increases landed by some, Americans are pessimistic about the economy. Only 21% of adults say that their finances were better off than a year ago, according to a survey released Tuesday, down from 26% when the question was asked a year earlier, even though, by most measures, the economy had improved substantially during that period. A survey of 5,365 adults was conducted last month for the New York Times by Momentiv, the online research firm formerly known as SurveyMonkey. Thank you for joining us for the Wednesday, January 5th edition of the Denver Post. My name is Cole.